Yeah, I mean, in the beginning was hard, right? Like two girls from university not having a track record and having this very fluffy kind of pitch where it's really hard to tell what the difference is to the million food applications out there. I don't think we could have come along this way if people were, you know, not really intrinsically motivated by our purpose to actually encourage everyday cooking, to get people into cooking. This kind of persistence, inner motivation and drive, this is something that really makes the difference.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of Speak Like a CEO. My name is Lina Carlson, and I'm here with Oliver Haft. Hey, Oliver.
Hey, Lina. Our guest today is Mengting Gao. She's the founder and CEO of Kitchen Stories. Kitchen Stories is fascinating. It started as a passion project by two graduates in 2013, and now reaches 30 million users each month on multiple channels. So there's lots to talk about with Mengting. She and her co-founder, Verena, built a global brand in a very crowded market. Just imagine how much cooking content is out there. First, they were rejected by investors, and a few years later, they managed to get a successful exit. They built a whole ecosystem of content from the website to a successful app to TikTok and many other social media channels. And even Apple CEO Tim Cook, no pun intended, made pancakes with them. A co-founder, Verena, recently went into politics and became a member of parliament this year. So lots to talk about. Welcome, Mengting.
Yes, hi. Thanks for having me.
Absolute pleasure. So what kind of food trends do you see at the moment?
Wow, food trends. That's a good question to start with. I would say, for one, starting with Beyond Meat, Impossible Foods, there are so many different varieties out there. And this is really great to see how the industry is developing in that regard. And we're seeing that more and more consumers are interested in these topics as well. And so slowly but surely reaching mass market attraction. And if you would ask me for trends like social media trends, it's been crazy to see how Squid Game has impacted food as well. Or at least, let's say, from a visual social media aspect. One of our photographers, he just recently released a video on the Dalgona cookie, and it has reached, I think, 90 million views within a very short amount of time. So that's been crazy. Yeah, everything is influencing food these days.
With Kitchen Stories, your tagline is anyone can cook. Why is this the mission that you guys have decided to follow?
Yeah, so from the, I would say, very beginning to today, what we are doing is to actually get anyone cooking and to encourage everyday cooking. That has really always been at our core, and I think always will be. We started this because we didn't really find the matching product for us to get Verena and me at that point in time really into cooking. So Verena is more, you know, the beginner. She was always very anxious when it came to cooking. She cooks pasta, as it says on the package, with a timer. So in like that. And for me, I have always been the cook show freak between the two of us. I've grown up in Germany with the first episodes of Jamie Oliver and Tim Meltzer, and I just always loved food content. But then, you know, when Jamie says it's going to take 15 minutes to create this whole menu, then some people, you know, after 60, they still are in the kitchen, me included, and wondering what's happening. So it was always about finding a way to create sort of the perfect experience that give you what is so great in food, this visual aspect that gives you an appetite and wants you to try things, but then also match it with the description that is so detailed that literally anyone can do it. In a way, it's how to create that perfect recipe to get anyone cooking. And we strongly believe that that will enable anyone out there who can basically hold a cooking spoon themselves to cook. And that is what drives us and our mission ultimately. And I really strongly believe that understanding how to prepare food, how to cook for yourself or what you put in your body will ultimately, you know, make the world maybe just that little bit of a better place to understand what you're actually nourishing yourself with.
Yeah. As I understand, kind of the point of difference on the website is that you can see like these kind of short visual clips of how to do things, as well as like step by step. You've got the written instructions with the pictures. So having that verbal cue as well. Do you think that's what makes the difference? And why do you think that visual and verbal collaboration is so important to enabling anyone to cook.
Yeah, so I do believe that when we started, that was what was quite different from the market. Today, I don't think it's so special anymore. And what I would think really sets us apart from our competition, and as you said, a very crowded market, is really the combination of three things. So the first thing is the content that we have that is very everyday recipe foolproof. So whether you're looking, you know, for five ingredients dinner that's really quick and fast to maybe like an elaborate dessert or something, but we've got you covered with really recipes that will work. If you try it, it will work. That is the reason why people are coming back, because they cook something and it works. Otherwise, they would probably not return on their free will. And so this everyday food content, that is really important to us. And then the second aspect is the intuitive technology that makes this possible. So we would not define ourselves as like, you know, a crazy tech company, but for us, tech is an important enabler to get this product across to the consumer. And so we were named, you know, best app on Apple and Google in two consecutive years on both platforms. We've won the design awards on both platforms. And that is also mostly because we try to create a product in a sense that within the first 1, 2, 3 seconds, people really know what they're getting and how to get to their desired dish, how to experience the recipes and how to actually use these products also for cooking. And so this, I think, is something that is also quite different to most of our competition. And then lastly, what rounds this up is that we truly have a very international community on our platform. We've always set out to be a global product, and we've done that. We are available in more than 150 countries. So Germany is our focus market. But if you look into our recipes, you will see people from Vietnam, Pakistan, the US talking with each other about a specific dish. And that is very unique in our industry, because mostly food has been viewed as something very local, I would say. But to my mind, it's one of the most important globally available things that we can exchange about and talk about. And to really embrace this internationality, I think that is really interesting. And if you look into our company as well, I think that's what makes our DNA. We're a very international team. We only have one German editor, you know, all of the others are from other places of the world. And to share their food experiences and to make this accessible in the German market, that is something I think that makes us also pretty special.
When you and Verena set up Kitchen Stories 2013, you're economist, right? You're not from the restaurant business. I think it's important to know, which probably explains partly your data-driven approach. Could you speak to that a little bit, how the data informed the evolution of Kitchen Stories and also the ecosystem you've built, starting with an app, but then obviously expanding into other forms of communications and other channels?
Yeah, so I think Verena and me, we are both business students and we have no clue actually how to cook or to code an application or to take photography and stuff. And so I think on the one hand, it had really impacted us in how we set up our operations. We always try to do it in a very effective and efficient way without actually thinking about what do you usually need in terms of creating a set for a video shoot or something, right? So we just did whatever made sense to us. And I think that made it a little bit different too. And then in our approach of creating content, we've always tried to do this very data informed, even until today. So 80% of our content was being created based on some data, right? So we are looking into trends on the one hand, so external data sources that might be Google Trends, that might be Pinterest trend reports, there might be all sorts of food reports out there, but we're also looking into our competition, right? So what is working super well there? What are some of the top hits that are happening? We have internal data, we're looking into search, things that people are looking for that we maybe don't cater to today, and customer feedback, etc., of course. And so we put all of that together. We look into seasonalities and these things, and 80% of the recipes we create are created from that. And so we do have a good understanding of what we think will work or won't work. And then 20% is pure gut feel of our editors, because we believe they are the ones who really understand the industry. And so they will see things before they're actually happening. This combination, I think, has allowed us to create great content for the users out there.
That's all very interesting. I would be curious also to know how you've monetized the model, essentially, because the platform is technically free for users.
Yes, exactly. So it's free for users. And already since the very beginning, where we didn't have any investors or not really any cash to begin with, it started actually out with us figuring out, okay, so if we do want to create these videos and those photos, how do we get all of the products like the pots and pans and the knives, etc.? If we wanted to make it super high quality, which was always something that we set out to do. Yeah, so because we knew we couldn't afford that, we called up the brands and we basically told them, look, we're going to create this product and we do believe that our target audience and your target audience are a great match. So how about helping us in sponsoring? And so what started as product placement, and back then for us was a lifesaver, because we made our first revenue, which in the early days, you know, it was like 25,000 euros probably before we created the very first version of the application. But that was the same amount of money we had to begin with. So it sort of like doubled our run rate at that point in time. And for us, it was a really big deal. And from that very simple sort of product placement situation, we then now have this like whole business that is working together with brands and creating what we call branded entertainment. So stories and recipes together with brands to really reach our target audience that might be a match to their audience as well. And so with the brands is actually how we monetize our platform today. And that might be very food related brands. So classic things such as Alpo, Dr. Edgar, you name it. But then we're also working together with brands such as Vodafone, such as Infarm, such as Nike, Lufthansa. So food is a very great environment, I would say. There are almost never bad news in food. We can create pretty great stories.
Yeah, I think your business model is really fascinating. And you mentioned in an earlier interview at the beginning, you said we didn't really have a business model. We're just figuring things out. And today, in hindsight, it looks really, really clever because you're both successful in B2C and successful in B2B. Now, the website you have where companies can explore opportunities to work with you as partners, as sponsors, etc., looks great. And it's so simple and it's miles head and shoulders above what others are doing. So I really think that's fantastic. And on the B2C side, you've recently introduced membership models, etc. So you have recurring revenue. So in terms of the business model evolution, maybe you could speak to that a little bit as well. And where do you see things developing in the future?
Yeah, definitely. So I think the B2B part that I just described, that's very clear. And we want to create more, right? We do strive to create even bigger, better stories with our brand. And we're, I would say, on a very good way there, and super interesting to create this kind of native content with them. As I think everyone knows, just pure in-your-face advertising is not really what people are looking for anymore. And so the content itself needs to be very enticing to make this work. So yeah, that's on the B2B side. And on the B2C side, I think this is also super interesting. So when we initially launched the app, we sold recipes. It's like almost so long ago that we tend to forget that we used to do that. Back then, I would say it worked really well. You know, we had a conversion of, I would say it was above 2% at that point in time. And the average basket was probably between 8 and 10 euros. So back then when we started this, we thought, you know, it's actually much better than we thought it would be. But we were also in a time where mobile applications were the big new thing and everyone was like super bullish to grow. And not super interested in revenue at that point in time. So we decided that we would nonetheless remove this for the time being. And slowly but surely, we are looking more and more again into B2C. And we have recently launched a product, a first initial test, I would call it. It's called Cookbook Plus. So basically, any user can save any kind of recipe from any website in the world within Kitchen Stories using our UI and UX ultimately to cook these recipes, but then saving it from any place in the world into their Kitchen Stories cookbooks, because we strongly believe people who love to cook, they have multiple sources, but it is hard to like keep the overview of all of that. And that has proven to be great for some of our core users because they love this feature. And I strongly believe that there will be much more features and potentially also content than we can include in a Kitchen Stories premium world. And so I wouldn't say I believe anymore in selling single pieces of content. That was like some time ago. But mix and matching functionality and content, that for sure, I think in food, there is still a lot of room to grow.
That's very cool. And I would say over even particularly like the last 2 years, like the food industry has had some huge changes, not only from, you know, consumer preferences, but with COVID and restaurants being shut, and everyone kind of adapting their model, maybe people being home more and cooking. What kind of insights have you guys seen from your side into consumer behavior there that you are kind of taking into the future now?
Yeah, so definitely. I mean, there has never been a better motivator, it feels like, for people to learn how to cook, but lockdown. And so suddenly everyone was looking for new skills and new projects. And it was crazy to see, for example, things such as banana bread were going through the roof. Obviously, there was no yeast readily available. I think that was one aspect. And baking was a big thing. So banana bread and sourdough bread both were going through the roof. That was insane to see. Yeah, so that has been part, I would say, of that development, that we had quite a huge chunk of users looking more into things that were maybe not so every day. So maybe a little bit more project-like with regards to food. That was super interesting to us. And then, yeah, what else is sort of very dependent on lockdown situation. I think in general, I wouldn't really know if it's just because of lockdown, but we do also on our platform, of course, see that people are much more interested in vegan and vegetarian dishes. There is a huge trend towards that, which is great, I think, to see. At the same time, on the weekends, people tend to lack a little bit in that. So they tend to gravitate towards very classic, hearty dishes.
Yeah, interesting. I remember Lena and I talk about sourdough during lockdown quite a lot. You're also quick to respond to social media trends, and you're quite active on TikTok, for instance. Could you elaborate a little bit on your experience with TikTok, you know, as a channel for your kind of content, also compared maybe with the other channels you're quite big on, Pinterest, Instagram, and so on?
Yeah. To be honest, for us, TikTok, it's not quite in focus. Like, we are trying some things there, but we are mostly refurbishing content. So we haven't really started producing for TikTok. I would say, are still in the testing phase of it. Of course, it's huge, but for us, at the same time, it also needs to be economical as well. And so for us, it's not just about adding more reach to the platform, but it's also about figuring out how to monetize that reach at the same time. So while Pinterest is for us mostly a really great traffic driver, so I would say in Germany, we're probably one of the largest food content providers on Pinterest. So that is truly important to get people onto our platform. On Instagram and TikTok, I guess, as we all know, they make it much harder to reach the actual website. And so there we need to evaluate how well can we monetize those platforms, actually. And while Instagram is good now for brands as well to create campaigns together and to monetize that channel, on TikTok, it's still newer and therefore also a little bit tougher with regards to monetization. So I would say we're still observing, you know, touch and go. We definitely don't want to miss it. And we see a ton of potential. But this is, yeah, I would say not on our priority list. What is more interesting, I think, is that We will now put much more effort into YouTube, and we're planning a bigger relaunch there. We do believe that the German market needs something more on YouTube than what is currently available. And so that for us is the much more interesting part at the moment.
It's actually super interesting to hear about your social media strategy, because I think it differs to a lot of other entrepreneurs who maybe not so much go with their gut, but go with what they know and what they like. And so for a lot of us, like, Instagram is a very comfortable platform. We use it every day. But you're so right, when you're taking it from this kind of like business aspect, it's completely different. And, you know, I would be really curious to know also more what you think will happen with YouTube, because there's been lots of changes going on the platform right now in terms of how it's set up and how people use it. So I would be just kind of curious to know why you're betting on it, or why you want to invest some time and money into it.
Yeah, so there are multiple things, I would say. So at the core, food content, I think, has a great chance on YouTube. Both it has gotten much more popular, but then also the watch times on food content are super attractive. So people are really willing to watch and spend a lot of time. It's very different to the snackable content on Insta or on TikTok. And this makes it much more interesting to build a relationship with the user there. And obviously, it will also help to monetize this kind of content as well. It is also much more at the core of what we're good at doing, producing this kind of content for our users, making it very evergreen as well. It's not so fleeting as a lot of social media is these days. And so this to us is super interesting. And again, I think the international food market, or the international food content on YouTube, has shown us how great this interest can be. And, you know, there are great names out there, such as Alison Roman, who I'm a great fan of, Joshua Weissman, you know, Molly Bass. There are so many people out there who have created amazing followerships and are creating amazing content on YouTube. And we do think that there is a whole lot of German users out there as well who would be interested in similar content, but they still do have this language preference for the German language. And so this for us is actually easy to make use of, because this is the type of content that also on other channels we are already creating.
Yeah, that's very smart. And obviously there are a lot of changes at the front end, how the algorithms work, the platforms change and evolve all the time. But there are lots of changes at the back end as well, how we produce content, which is why we build our own studio now. So we have a sort of video / podcast production studio, because we know we have to be professional without over-engineering it, right? You can also do too much and overproduce things. So I was just curious how, you know, What does your production facility look like? How do you manage to produce that much quality content for various channels?
So how does it look like? So first, we build our office here in Berlin, and we build in four kitchens, sort of three shoot kitchens, one test kitchen, and one for the team. And so we have facilities here where we can actually do these productions. And we have our own in-house team. So what we do for our Kitchen Stories content, we do it all in-house. We surely are from time to time also working with freelancers, etc. But we have a core team that is really thinking about this each and every day and trying to make this work. And I think this is part of the secret sauce, you know. We have editors with us in video, in photo, but also in editorial. They have been with us for many, many years. And they're really interested in making a difference in this food industry. And I think their creativity and bringing that to life, that is the most important part of my job, to sort of support them in doing that. And yeah, just give them a go at trying out new things.
It's really cool. So, I mean, now you've been in the business for quite a long time. What are some of the learnings you have along the way in terms of being a successful entrepreneur?
What are some of the learnings? I think one of the most important parts, especially as an entrepreneur, I would say, is persistence. I think, you know, the idea and the team, everything is really important. But I think ultimately it's about always figuring out a new way, especially if it's not going the way that we planned or expected something to go, which I think is most of the time. And to really just never give up and continue and find a different way and always question whether what we're doing is actually right or wrong. I think this kind of persistence, inner motivation and drive, this is something that really makes the difference. I don't think we could have come along this way if people were, you know, not really intrinsically motivated by our purpose to actually encourage everyday cooking, to get people into cooking, and to be able to live this in a creative way.
One of the areas you showed a lot of persistence is obviously fundraising. In the beginning, it was very difficult. You said previously you had to bootstrap and you had to, really claw your way, through the first few years. But then obviously you managed to, sell a big chunk of it, I think the majority of the company a few years later. Could you speak to that evolution of your fundraising history and how you changed maybe the message from, oh, it's another cooking app potentially to, okay, this is a really fantastic investment opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, in the beginning was hard, right? Like two girls from university not having a track record and having this very fluffy kind of pitch where it's really hard to tell what the difference is to the million food applications out there. So we raised some money from FFF, as we call it, friends, family, fools, right? So people who had to believe in us and not truly in the business. And we started with these 25,000 euros that you need in Germany to start the GmbH. Only after launch, people realized what it was about, because we launched the product with this 25,000, got a student developer in, got some other students in to do like the whole production thing, did it very low cost. Took us probably to get the full product live, took us probably 5 months or so. But then within the first 2 weeks of being live, and we did not, until this day, we are not spending a single send in purchasing installs. So everything is organic. And today I think we have more than 22 million installations worldwide. And back then in the first 2 weeks, it was maybe 60,000 installs. And it was quite a lot at that point in time, actually, and no one expected it. And suddenly people realized, there is a benefit to this and users are seeing the value in it. And this actually then drove the first angels to us. But we still, we spend each night, Verena and me, after 8 p.m., we had a list of people that we wanted to contact, and we just called them up each night. We, like, each person called up a couple of people, not to ask them whether they had money for us, but because we identified them based on their industry knowledge or their positions, and we just asked them if they would be willing to spend some time with us and to share some of their knowledge with us. I think, business angels, they're smart enough, right? Like if they're interested, they will offer themselves to invest or not. You don't have to like really ask them. So for us, it was really about figuring out, can we get into an exchange? And are these people that we want to work with, are these people we can call at, one at night if something goes wrong, and can they actually help us? I think this is something super important. And now it's so great to see that, after so many years, I mean, KitchenStory is also now 8 years old. I think now the industry here in Berlin is very different. There are so many angels now out there who have been serial entrepreneurs themselves. And it's important, I think, to choose the right angels for you in the beginning that have a similar mindset, that can support you, have industry knowledge, and that you feel comfortable with. So I think this is super important. And then ultimately, we raised a Series A soonish after, and then only sort of 4 years after founding the company, we also exited it, which was not necessarily planned. But at that point in time, we just knew that a strategic investor would be the right choice for us and for this industry. And so, we decided to go down that route. And I don't know, I think these days, the rounds are very different now. The sizes are very different. There is a lot of money in the market. I can now enjoy it from the other perspective too, because I'm on the board of EQT Ventures. And so now I get to see it from an investor's point of view, which is also super interesting. And there's so much opportunity at the moment in the market that I wish every entrepreneur good luck of closing these rounds.
It's very cool. And I was also curious to know, How did you get Tim Cook from Apple in your kitchen?
Yeah, how did that happen? So we've always had a very, close relationship with Apple, as close as it could be, I guess, as a developer. And so we always knew that we wanted to create a very native product and making sure that we use any kind of new technology to our advantage and for the benefit of the user as well. And so I think Apple also really, in a sense, appreciated that we try to really make use of their new technologies and their new features and integrate it as best as possible into Kitchen Stories. So we always had a sense, you know, that we got these like promotions, etc. In the beginning was maybe luck that someone discovered us. But then over the years, it was also a lot of relationship building and a lot of investment involved. And
you said you weren't quite sure that he would be the person coming. So what happened? Someone from Apple called you and said, oh, someone from Apple will come and wants to make pancakes with you?
Sort of. So now we, of course, have one contact person at Apple who has been with us for all these years, basically, and we've always been in exchange. And we got to know that there would be someone visiting from Apple. We had already people visit from Apple before, you know, from other places too. And so we didn't make too much of it. But then we, over the time, felt, okay, there's a lot of preparation going into this, so maybe it's a bigger thing. And then we investigated a little bit ourselves, right? So we looked a little bit where Tim Cook was, and it was, I remember, I think that it was clear that he would be in Europe during that point in time. It wasn't even clear, I think, that he would come to Germany. So we sort of put one and one together and we're like, okay, so this could happen, you know, who knows?
Why not?
So cool.
I'd love to also ask you about Verena and her decision to depart and go into politics. And she's now in the German parliament. So how did that evolve? So you must have had a very frank conversation where she said at some point, okay, you know what, Mengting, I'm going to politics. And then you have 60-odd employees. So, you know, it was probably quite surprising for them as well. So how did you manage that from an internal perspective?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, internally speaking, it wasn't that, you know, she had to leave us for politics. It was more two separate decisions, I would say. I think we came together and we knew that, you know, it's time for the next stage of the company. It's a different scaling stage at this at the company. And at that point in time, it was already clear that maybe it wasn't like so much for Verena at that point in time. She was always interested in politics. It had always been a topic. But the two of us, we knew that we would change something about our structure anyhow. And so the way we try to approach is that we got a coach in and we sat down together and we discussed with the coach what kind of options we would have, where each person's strengths are and where we see our life sort of heading and also the life of the business heading. And then we decided that it would probably make sense, you know, for me to get a new CEO or COO in and for her to find her way in politics. And so it was a very, very calm, very clear decision that we took. And we also took our time with it. So we got to this decision super quickly, I think also because we've always been very open to each other. So we sort of knew this point would come. And then we took another year to actually do the transition. And a lot of things happened during that time, right? Like the political opportunity was there. I think back then it was like 3 days after we decided. I got the news that I was pregnant, which was also like very unplanned for. And so with all of these new information, we set up a transition plan over the course of a year, basically, to find a new MD during this time to do the transition, to fade her out, and to provide her enough time for her political career as well. And so, yeah, I would say it was very planned out.
Wow, that's a lot going on and lots of organization behind the scenes. Before we wrap up, what would be your final piece of communications advice for people listening?
My advice in communication, I think what I have learned for myself, what has always worked best, is to be as transparent as possible. I think that taking people along the way of my thought train and also evaluating different kinds of options, speaking about processes, you know, before the end result is there, this, I think, in communication is so, so valuable. We at Kitchen Stories are trying to be as transparent as possible. If it's like not a super highly confidential information, we will try and share it with the necessary people. And I think this is often a little bit underrated. People tend to love to speak about things when they're very sure about it, but it leaves a lot of people behind. And so being as transparent as possible from the beginning out, I think that to me has always been the most helpful. Might take a little bit more time, but it usually pays off in the end.
What would be your advice to young founders who are trying to build an audience in order to, you know, to promote their product or build the company? Because that's clearly getting harder now.
Yeah, it's it is definitely tough. It's a very crowded market. I mean, also now with like so many influencers and therefore like sort of like one person companies in a sense, and the grasp for attention is like really tricky. But I think ultimately, you know, it has always felt that way. And with a new form of media, there is like a new opportunity as well. For me, it has always worked to try and create a product that I would really love and where I feel that there is a difference, no matter if others find that that's like a hard USP or not. Didn't really care about that. I wanted to make sure that if truly I were the customer, I see that it's truly making a significant difference in my life. Yeah, I wouldn't know if that works for everyone, but that is my approach.
It's almost, you know, be as authentic and be as good with your content that the algorithm doesn't matter, right?
Exactly.
If you manage to do that.
Exactly. I mean, ultimately, if that touches people or it relates to people, it provides this kind of edge, there will always be the opportunity. I mean, just last week, I think we looked into a vegan blogger and she got to, I think, 1 million followers in less than a year on her own. I mean, wow. So you know, every day there are still new possibilities.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we could easily talk for another few hours. There's so many things we'd like to ask you, so maybe do a second round at some point. And thank you so much. I mean, so many insights, such a great company, so inspiring. I saw a few recipes I want to try out today, you know, tonight, this week, some really inspiring stuff because, you know, if anyone can cook, maybe I can cook too, even though I haven't figured it out, but you make it really easy and intuitive.
That's the mentality. Thanks so much, Mintin.
Let me know how it worked out.
I will. Take care. Thank you all for listening and see you next week.
Thank you for having me.